Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So as it was reported by us when it came over the transom late in yesterday's show, Elon Musk successfully put together a takeover bid accepted by Twitter's board of directors. So he is the proud new owner of a social media company. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Are you exuberant about this development, or are you taking more of a wait and see approach? I'll tell you, one response I find interesting, because I find his commentary interesting always, is Victor Davis Hanson. And, you know, he's an understated, measured guy. And he was on with Martha McCallum on Fox yesterday talking about this. And, you know, I don't know if I would use the term exuberant, but pretty optimistic, pretty encouraged was Victor Davis Hanson.
Silicon Valley and the left think, you know, we got to be careful about this guy. He took Tesla and everybody thought he was a nut. Mm-hmm. And it's the largest company in the world, auto company in the world on the basis of market capitalization. It's worth over $1 trillion. Yeah. And he did that himself. And maybe he has expansive plans. Maybe he wants to have Twitter as a platform and go into what Facebook does or Google does. Mm-hmm. Or Snapchat or Instagram and just revolutionize the whole Silicon Valley. And he might have the money and the wherewithal and the public support and political support behind him. So you're starting to see the left, Martha, say things like, oh, it's just an elite medium. It's just for mostly liberals, mostly white, mostly bicoastal people.
Yeah.
It's not that important, because they understand that they're losing this very important avenue to people's expression. Elon Musk's motto, his slogan, his message is, let's open it up to everybody. But their message by needs or by definition, since it's, you know, lockstep antithetical to his, is let's censor people. Let's continue to deny expression, even to the former president of the United States. That's not a winning message. So Is Obama and Biden and all these people going to say, let's stop Elon Musk because we do not want free expression? That's what it boils down to. They can say all they want. In the end, they're just going to, if it's successful, and I think it will be if he wants to, they're just going to say, well, this was an irrelevant medium anyway. It wasn't worth that much. But I think it's the start of a revolution that could expand well beyond Twitter.
Start of a revolution?
Did you smile when you heard the news? Because I did, because the first thing I thought was, how soon until President Trump is allowed back on Twitter? And what will this mean for the 2024 election?
Well, President Trump's not coming back to Twitter, he says.
No, he says he's not, but come on. You dangle that type of carrot in front of that guy, I think he'll be back on Twitter. I mean, that's everybody. CNN, his tweets led the A block for 4 years. Everybody
wants
him
back. Yeah, well, that was maybe to CNN's benefit. I'm not so sure how much it was to Trump's benefit. But regardless, he's got this enterprise called Truth Social that he's trying to capitalize on. And so I don't know. I think I'm not saying Truth Social has got it together, because there's no indication it does. But obviously that's his name associated with it. And so I don't think he's going to give that up so readily, regardless of whether Trump comes back or not. The more interesting thing may be who stays, of course, because you have the performative left, you know, threatening to shut down their accounts, shutting down their accounts. It's sort of what VDH said, is that they're now it's suggesting, oh, it's not that important after all, because it can't be our we don't believe it will continue to be our personal playground where the people that we want censored or banned are censored or banned and so forth. So maybe it wasn't all that important. And by the way, I know Elon Musk said at that TED conference in Canada a couple weeks back that he doesn't care about the money, but you know, he's not in this alone. You've got a private equity firm, Thoma Bravo. And by the way, that's Carl Thoma, who is also GTCR Capital co-founder. That was Rahner's big private equity concern in Chicago, along with his partners. So these are serious people, and they've got serious money on the line. And so, you know, Elon Musk is going to now have to make this company worth the $44 billion he paid for it.
Right. But you have people on the left like Jeff Bezos suggesting China might lean on Elon Musk to get leverage over Twitter. And then you have this group. I have to play this for you.
China might. China might lean on. China leans on these social media companies and they comply.
Exactly. And then we're because, you know, the Chinese batteries for the Teslas are, or the batteries for the Teslas are made in China. Who cares? But this one woman, she's from the Rebellion Pack executive director, excuse me. She is the Rebellion Pack. Are you familiar with that, Dan? Yes. Brianna Wu. They're afraid some women and minority groups fear the pursuit of free speech will collide with safety.
I don't trust Elon Musk to make Twitter better for women at all. I just absolutely don't. If you're asking yourself if this is someone that's going to go to bat for people that are underrepresented, I just don't think that's going to be the case, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know. He's a white guy, so I don't even know what that means. I don't even the whole you know, is it going to be safe for BIPOCs? Is it going to be safe for this? Is he going to go to bat for this person? The whole point of a free marketplace of ideas is go to bat for yourself.
Yeah, and Musk hopes that his critics remain on Twitter in honor of free speech. And isn't that what this is all about? I mean, Alex Berg, there's a whole list of people that people want to go back to Twitter.
Alex Berenson. Is that what it's all about? Is it clear? I mean, I guess give Musk the benefit of the doubt per his public pronouncements, but there are other pressures on him that have nothing to do with China. There are financial pressures for him to make this company profitable. And so there's going to be tension there, not just with leftist blue check mafia types who will or won't keep their accounts, but advertisers, because at least right now, that's the business model. And Twitter is a very small big tech company by comparison to the Facebooks and the Googles and the Amazons of the world, we understand. So we'll see is sort of how I'm approaching this. I mean, it's easy to pore over the reactions to the left. But the more interesting thing is the pressure that Musk is under and the balancing act that he must do. He didn't, you know, write a check for $44 billion. He has other parties here.
Right, other
investors. There's a good piece actually in Revolver News back the beginning of this month when it was the first prospect that Musk could engineer this takeover. And they go through this pitched battle that he now is facing and will face. And what they suggest will happen is the first thing will happen is blame the platform for its users. So as soon as there is any tweet that can be characterized fairly or unfairly as racist, homophobic, transphobic, so on and so forth, then it's going to be, well, that's Elon Musk's platform now. He's a suborner of this sort of hate. That's going to be number one to undermine it. Number two, coordinated pressure campaigns. Think of designated hate speech by somebody, and then you got like the ADL or somebody comes in and calls for, you know, like Jonathan Greenblatt, who's forever trying to get advertisers to boycott Tucker, Fox to take Tucker off the air. Then he comes in and he has put pressure on Twitter before when it came to what he considered anti-Semitic content on Twitter. So he comes in and adds pressure to this, which puts a squeeze on advertisers, and then the exodus of the blue checks, because you have to signal to the world that I'm leaving out of principle because I'm a good person and I'm an important person and I'm an influencer. And the way that I maintain my influence is to make a big public show of leaving Twitter. So there's all, just some of the things. And then, and by the way, the other thing they say, which is interesting, and think about this, deplatforming. If you have the institutional interests allied against you, you think Twitter's too big to deplatform? The argument they make, if America's ruling class acting in concert can silence a sitting United States president, they're capable of cutting off virtually anything. The same tools that can be used against Twitter that have been used for it, banning links to web content, for example, Facebook could do that. Google could minimize their search results, right? Essentially derank the search results that relate to Twitter, which reduces traffic, which reduces the eyeballs there, which reduces its attractiveness to advertisers. I mean, this is not a slam dunk for Elon Musk and his partners, is the point.
312-642-5600, or you can also text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Brian, St. John, Indiana.
Hey, real quick, maybe my ears are mistaking me, but that sound clip you just played, did that woman just literally say that Twitter, Elon Musk is going to not protect women on Twitter?
Mm-hmm.
How about she goes to the NCAA and asks that question? That's all I got.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Yeah, there's a lot of that. The NAACP is calling on Musk to not reinstate Trump on Twitter. And Sean King, the white Black Lives Matter dude, is, you know, it's a white supremacist. He's a white supremacist apologist and so on and so forth. And he's canceled his account, leading the, you know,
the
exodus
charge, right,
to, you know, make a public display of themselves.
And then, you know, Biden's concerned about harms caused by social media. Jen Psaki was asked that question.
Everybody, right? We're all back to concerns about this. And Ari Melber, MSNBC, he's very concerned all of a sudden about censoriousness on social media. Imagine
you own all of Twitter or Facebook or what have you. You don't have to explain yourself. You don't even have to be transparent. You could secretly ban one party's candidate or all of its candidates, all of its nominees, or you could just secretly turn down the reach of their stuff and turn up the reach of something else, and the rest of us might not even find out about it till after the election. Elon Musk says this is all to help people because he is just a free speech, philosophically clear, open-minded helper.
Uh-huh. So Melber's being sarcastic because that's his job on MSNBC. So he's worried about, oh, my goodness, Elon Musk would shadow ban people. Elon Musk would censor people. I mean, I know this is, you know, so easy. This is the low-hanging fruit. But so now all of a sudden, after James O'Keefe's exposés on shadow banning, where he's got Twitter engineers talking to his undercover reporters, telling you what they do and to whom they do it, and all that we know about the banning, and all that we know about Robert Epstein's research on Google and its manipulation of algorithms for search results to influence elections. Now we're very concerned that Elon Musk would use Twitter to influence elections, to pick winners and losers, to put his finger on the scale for some content at the expense of others. So, in other words, Artie, the stuff that the left in charge, Jack Dorsey and company, in addition to the other big tech folks, have been doing, you know, since their ascent, right? Now you're concerned about that. Okay. Alex Hinsdale. Hey, Alex.
Hey, good morning. Quick comment. I find it interesting that the reason that myself and my family, for the most part, left the Democratic Party is they don't want to present their ideas because they're unpalatable. Open borders, exporting the jobs. They want to stifle debate. And I think that the Twitter takeover by Elon is, I think it's groundbreaking because they don't have the corner on the market now. And lastly, I find it ironic that the owner of Amazon and the Washington Post is criticizing someone about being easy on China when he does business there, when he's gone against unions, which the Democrats supposedly are for. I find it very ironic. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Alex. Ironies abound when it comes to the left.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about Musk's successful takeover bid on Twitter yesterday, accepted by Twitter's board of directors. So he is the proud new owner of a social media company. And
I had the White House pretty concerned. I mean, Jen Psaki addressed it. I don't know if you want to hear it, because I don't say Jen, what you do. You want to hear it?
Please.
But you got to say your name. Because I can't say her name the way you say her name.
Let's hear what she has to say.
Okay.
Can tell you as a general matter, no matter who owns or runs Twitter, the president has long been concerned about the power of large social media platforms, the power they have over our everyday lives, has long argued that tech platforms must be held accountable for the harms they cause. He has been a strong supporter of fundamental reforms to achieve that goal, including reforms to Section 230, enacting antitrust.
Okay. You know the rest. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be fantastic if Trump got back on Twitter. I think that would help. I mean, if he did decide to run in 2024, I think that would seal the deal. Because he could reach more people that way. He could reach his followers. I don't know. I just think he'd have fun with Biden. At the very least, he would have fun with Biden's mishaps.
Jack Dorsey, the former CEO and co-founder of Twitter.
Man with the little hands.
He came out of the Shire in which he resides to comment on this. You know, there's about $4 billion that separate Jack Dorsey from the QAnon shaman, I think.
Okay.
And that's about it. In principle, I don't believe anyone should own or run Twitter. It wants to be a public good at a protocol level, not a company. Solving for the problem of it being a company, however, Elon is the singular solution I trust. I trust his mission to extend the light of consciousness.
Oh my God.
Is he a tech CEO or is he the Dalai Lama, Jack Dorsey?
I think he's the former tech CEO, now the Dalai Lama.
These guys are they're so weird. They're so detached and they're so up their own behinds. Like, I'm a deep abstract thinker now. Meanwhile, he's, you know, focused on mining Bitcoin. He goes on to tweet, Elon's goal of creating a platform that is maximally trusted and broadly inclusive is the right one. This is also the current CEO's goal, why I chose him. Thank you both for getting the company out of an impossible situation. This is the right path. I believe it with all my heart. Well, if Jack Dorsey's lending his heart to this effort, then that's all the endorsement I need. Hi, my gee, they're just so, you know, mythical figures. You know, a guy had a good idea and he executed pretty well enough to make him a billionaire. Congratulations.
Now go home.
It doesn't mean you're the oracle of the West, which is how, or the East, really, which, given his rhetoric, which is sort of how Jack Dorsey, sees himself. Just weirdo. Anyway, all right, we need to get to some additional reaction from the left, real-time reaction, very raw, as he always is. Cassidy Campbell, also known as Marty Epstein, was before the Plano, Texas City Council last evening, and I know what you're thinking. What does the Plano City Council have to do with Twitter? Not that much. But it is a platform for people to express themselves. It's a free speech zone. Mm-hmm. And Cassidy Campbell, a la Marty Epstein, a.k.a. Marty Epstein, took advantage of it.
This man is evil. And this was my favorite platform. And I'm going to tell you why it is ruined. Hello, my fellow queer and non-binary friends. My name is Marty Epstein. My pronouns are they, them. And as you all know, today will go down as the most horrific day in history, surpassing the Holocaust, due to the fact that Nazi white supremacist Elon Musk has purchased Twitter so that him and his Nazi heterosexual friends will be able to post their problematic anti-science beliefs and get away with it. This is a threat to our democracy. Recently, Elon tweeted that Netflix is waiting for the war to end so that they can make a movie about a black Ukrainian guy who falls in love with a transgender Russian soldier. This is disgusting. Not only is this racist and transphobic, but I do not find it funny at all. And unlike Elon, I am way funnier than him. Here is a joke I wrote. Now listen to it and tell me who is funnier, me or Elon the Nazi. How many white supremacists does it take to change a light bulb? None, because white supremacists don't believe in change. Somebody laugh. Thank you. Otherwise, I'll cancel you. Elon Musk is Hitler reincarnated, and this is very problematic. My fellow queer council members, I say to you that democracy is in the balance. So are you going to side with swastikas or with rainbows? Also, for the record, I would like to state that I love everyone and believe that everyone deserves free speech as long as their beliefs align with mine. Do you not care about our future generation, or do you live in an echo chamber where you can't hear the cries of your normal, everyday person like me who is begging to for you to save us from this fascist? Do you not hear me, or do you just not care? Do you realize that shortly Donald Trump will shortly be reinstated on Twitter, where he will be able to promote his dangerous ideas to the whole world once again? Let me tell you some of the hateful things that Donald Trump has said. He said the news is fake. He said that Alec Baldwin's career was dead, which is disgusting and hateful. I loved him in The Cat in the Hat. And he had the nerve to call the coronavirus the Chinese virus. And because of some wacky conspiracy that it came from China, he called people losers and haters and refuses to accept the election results. That is denying reality. Lastly, due to Elon Musk buying Twitter, this Friday, I will officially be moving to Ukraine with my non-binary best friend. And this is a one-way ticket. I am gone. Are you not going to miss me? Because you will miss me. You will miss me. I am leaving to Ukraine to meet Vladimir Zelensky at the airport.
Time. Thank you.
And his hair is dyed orange, and I think it was pink on one side, and then it looks like he's wearing a Starbucks apron.
He's wearing a dog collar.
And a dog collar, too. And
it's very nice. Very nice.
Rainbow
touch.
Suspenders on.
So that's Cassidy Campbell, aka Marty Epstein, weighing in on the topic. So is he more or less ridiculous than that effete egghead? And I mean that just because his head is shaped like an egg, not because he's bright. Brian Stelter on CNN.
Look, who knows? I think that's an example of a broader question for Twitter, which is, if you get invited to something where there are no rules, where there is total freedom for everybody, do you actually want to go to that party?
Yeah.
Or are you going to decide to stay home? And that's a question for Twitter users. Some Twitter users might love the idea that there's going to be absolutely no moderation and no rules at all. Others might not want to be anywhere near that. Am I crazy, Matt?
They sound similar.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. It's similar hysterics, just from a different angle. Brian Stelter is...
I still do not know how he has that job.
He's a goof. But, I mean, look at this, the cast of characters on CNN. He's in good company. So, absolute no content moderation. It's Wild West. It's freedom. It's scary. Freedom is slavery. I mean, it's sort of the Orwellian, the passive-aggressive Orwellian comment from Brian Stelter. But it's also something I just thought his comment was interesting on a couple levels. One is, that's not the position. No content moderation whatsoever. The position should be, and Elon Musk sort of indicated it would be in his interview at that TED conference in Canada the other week. Basically, what the law is. What the law that governs speech. So pretty simple standard here. Constitutional law and statutory law that has been deemed constitutional in the area of freedom of speech. So, you know, you can't make threats to an individual, or you can't threaten individual people with violence, and so on and so forth. The pretty straightforward where there are appropriate restraints on speech. So that's number one. Like, this is so complicated. How do you figure out how to do this? Just apply Supreme Court jurisprudence and statutory law to the platform. Say this is what informs our norms on this platform. It's just not that complicated. I've been saying this for years. It's not complicated. Number one. Number two, freedom. Freedom is slavery. A freedom of slavery to the libertine individual. And the libertine individual and the autocrat are two sides of the same coin. Brian Seltzer has no idea what I'm talking about. Yeah. But that's what he is, and that's what he's saying. The idea that freedom or liberty and libertinism are synonyms. They're antonyms. They're antonyms. Freedom necessarily includes restraint. And the question is, you know, what restrains man's conduct? And that's a deeper philosophical question. But just this idea that he was promoting, freedom is frightening. People won't want to go to that party where there are individuals expressing themselves in a restrained, responsible way consistent with the individual liberties upon which this country was founded. That's frightening to Brian Stelter. And he's imposing that fright on other people, but he's really speaking for them as one of them, isn't he?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Tony, Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan. A question, and I have it for a reason. Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Fair Act Law, Fair Labor Act Law, did he implement the 5-day work week?
I
don't think he did.
The Fair Labor Standards Act,
minimum wage,
child labor laws. I don't think it was 5-day work week.
Correct. Okay. So here's here's the point I wanted to make. We're all talking about Twitter, which I think could actually be a good thing. But again, where are the leaders stepping out front and center? Get your issues, include this, and keep banging away at it like the Democrats do. We all talk about social media, but we're not talking about one of the most, what I think is becoming a pretty insidious platform, which is LinkedIn, which I have to use all the time. And people are sneaking their agendas into the platform. Mm-hmm. And the reason I asked about the Fair Labor Act was an example is there's a CEO, and many are coming out now. We're implementing a 4-day work week. We're doing this. We're doing that. I didn't know in California there's a bill that's being put forth for a 32-hour work week, and if you work over 32 hours, you have to pay overtime. And this is going to be mandated by California state law, supposedly, if it passes. And you have this being pushed, but then you have people making up things, such as I just stated. Nobody's going to call these people out on LinkedIn. And this stuff is starting to be more and more apparent. And you've got business people don't want to react because you're going to get slapped. And it's starting, and it's getting bigger and bigger. So I just think that's something to look out for. Thank you.
Right. Thanks,
and it was President Franklin Roosevelt who signed the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 that established the 5-day, 40-hour work week, by the way.
That was included in the?
Yes, it was.
I don't recall. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey. Good morning, Dan and Amy. And listen, this whole thing with Elon Musk, I'll tell you, the left, they always push things way too far, and they kick themselves on the foot for going too far. But here's the thing. Elon Musk, they were jacking with him back a little bit, like when he was putting something on, Elon Musk put something on there, and they pulled something down and were jerking with him. And I'll bet you that was a time. Elon Musk's personality must be Trump's, and maybe even stronger in the case that you poke him, he pokes you back. He probably made that decision at that time. I'm going to take this damn company over and everything like that, and we'll see if they can pull me down. They were able to pull down Trump, and they thought, oh, yeah, we'll pull down Musk too. But Musk had the money to basically give him a black eye back. What do you think about that, Dan?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Craig. I mean, I assume there's a bigger play here than just the personal back and forth that Musk had with his tweets being regulated. But I think he maybe saw that as that was a spark that said, you know, this is actually a company that I could take over, and we could do something with it, and we could make this an example for other big tech companies. Or, as Victor Davis Hanson said, we could perhaps spark a little revolution in the direction of free speech within big tech. I don't know. I don't know exactly what his thinking is. I assume he's got some big ideas for Twitter. Otherwise, this is, you know, sort of an expensive game of vengeance. And again, he's not the only one who's got skin in the game here. But with respect to the left going too far, I disagree. A friend of mine put it well in terms of describing this. You know, it's easy, as we were doing, to pick out the hypocrisy of the left. The Ari Melbers and the Brian Stelters and all the journalists who are pro-censorship to save our democracy as a norm. They're enlisting private actors to do what they cannot yet get the state to do in this country. But if they could get the state to do it, they'd do it in a second. They could get the state, if we could amend the First Amendment to restrict individuals' free speech rights, those journalists on Twitter promoting shadow banning and censorship and banning outright, they'd happily support that, just as they support a real repeal of the Second Amendment altogether. Sure they would. But the left isn't going too far. It's what the left is. And my friend put it well. They're like a swarm of killer bees. They don't know right from wrong. All they know is attack.
Yep.
So there is no going too far, because this is what they are, and this is what they do. Like a swarm of killer bees, they just see something and attack.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
then
why
go to the next thing.
Elon Musk tweeted, "I hope that even my worst critics remain on Twitter, because that is what free speech means."
Yeah, okay, well, that's a, you know, positively prosaic statement. But yes, right, get his position, we'll see. But that's not who they are.
Because people are afraid that some people on the left were afraid that he was going to silence them and take them off Twitter. You know what they've been doing
people,
to the right.
People on the left are not afraid of that. No, they're not afraid of that. And to take anything they say at face value is to make the first mistake. They're not afraid of that. They do not want this platform or any other one to be a place that is beyond their control. Control, or the lack thereof, is what they're afraid of, which is what they're interested in, and it's what they're afraid of. You know, it'd be interesting, too. I know this recently concluded election in France. Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder, you know, in France, they ban exit polling. In France, from midnight on Friday to the election
on Sunday,
over the weekend, yeah, there's a period of electoral silence during which French media are barred from quoting candidates or publishing opinion polls, so they don't influence voters. Those rules also apply to candidates and their teams, strictly barred from campaigning the last 44 hours before voting ends on Sunday.
Yeah, that's when in America they really turn up the heat.
I wonder if the press, in order to save our democracy, would willingly adopt those restrictions on themselves, those same journalists who promote censorship both privately, and they certainly would publicly if they could get their hands on the state.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. There's legislation in California kicking around its state assembly. It's AB 2223, for those of you scoring at home, authored by Buffy Wicks of Oakland.
Buffy
from Oakland.
Wicks.
Yeah.
Real name?
Real name.
Are you sure?
As far as I know.
Or is that her stage name, if you know what I mean?
Legislation could, according to some, legalize infanticide for weeks after a baby is born.
Okay. Isn't that called homicide?
Well.
Because technically that is a homicide in most states in the country. And in European countries, too.
It would remove outdated provisions requiring coroners to investigate certain pregnancy losses and ensure that information collected about pregnancy loss is not used to target people through criminal or civil legal systems. Persons shall not be subject to civil or criminal liability or penalty or otherwise deprived of their rights based on their actions or omissions with respect to their pregnancy or actual, potential, or alleged pregnancy outcome, including miscarriage, stillbirth, or abortion, or perinatal death. Charles Lemandry from the Thomas More Society said that the altered language would allow the language in legislation would allow for the murder of babies weeks, months, or even years after they are born. He said the false narrative is exposed here. The abortion lobby has been peddling for half a century that no one knows when life begins and babies in their mother's wombs feel no pain. By including perinatal in its provisions, the bill would authorize the murder of infants even after they are born. And he notes, does the attorney for the Thomas More Society, that perinatal varies spanning weeks or even years after an infant is born. Now, this is a subject of discussion, and the legislation has been amended again. And all the fact checkers are out saying that, no, it would not provide for the murder of a child outside the womb. But Thomas More Society attorneys seem to disagree. So that's important. But let's just say, for example, let's just say for the sake of argument that it would. That this legislation would allow for exactly what the Thomas More Society lawyer says it would. Okay. Meaning infanticide. That was the jumping off point for a woman named Savannah Hernandez, who's one of these YouTubers that the kids are so hepped up about.
Yeah, they don't watch TV. All they watch is YouTube.
Uh-huh. And she's got a little YouTube program called Rapid Fire, which she does man on the street stuff. So Savannah Hernandez went out to ask some Californians, the denizens of Venice Beach, to be specific, about their support for infanticide. Here's man on the street number one, some surfer dude.
This is Savannah Hernandez here in Venice Beach. Now, California is trying to pass a bill to legalize infanticide 7 days post-birth. Let's go see what Californians think of the bill.
So I prefer that most women make their decisions at 8 weeks, but I'm also in support of 10 months out of the womb.
So you think babies should be aborted 10 months after they're born?
If the mother wants to, yes.
Oh, my. Okay. Please tell me he was on something.
Don't know.
Besides the ground.
Here's two young ladies who stopped to answer Ms. Hernandez's questions and share their own stories of abortion. Take a listen.
I think them kids. So if like you want to get a late term abortion, like that's up to you. You know, I've had an abortion too, and it was my choice, and I'm happy I had that choice. Because if you're talking about like post birth, that's not considered an abortion. Like you can look up abortion in the dictionary.
But would it be considered murder at that point?
I mean, if somebody were to, abandon their child in a dumpster, they would be, and they were found, like, yes, they would be charged. Like, there are actual cases of that happening. That's child neglect. And anyone who's putting their child in harm's way, like, I think there should be definitely, like, things put in place to make sure that children are safe. Anything that is, you know, pre-birth, if it involves termination of a fetus, that's considered an abortion. I 100% support it. I've had an abortion myself. I'm not a bad person because I made the choice that was right for me, and now I have a life that I enjoy, and I wouldn't take it back.
Would you guys get an abortion again?
Yes. 100%.
100
yeah.
times. I'd do it multiple times.
Until I feel that I'm ready to parent, that's a choice I'll continue to make.
Are you weeping for your nation yet? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Very interesting. The one woman who was trying to explain, and she was having difficulty, obviously, that she opposes parents neglecting their children, but she doesn't oppose parents murdering their children. Okay. I'm not a bad person. I had an abortion. I'm not a bad person. Did anybody say you were a bad person? Why do you feel the need to say that? It's almost like she thinks there's some stigma attached to it. Why would there be stigma attached to it? You and your friend there are celebrating it.
Well, because she knows deep in her heart that it's wrong. That conjecture on my part, but that's what I was thinking when I was hearing her speak.
I had an abortion. I'm not a bad person. Well, nobody's saying you're bad.
She said it in the same breath. Yeah.
Nobody's saying you're a bad person. And this is, of course, one of the challenges of moving in the direction of a culture of life in this country is the guilt and the shame that people feel that they don't say that they say they don't feel, and the idea that if somebody. If people advocate, if laws were passed to say this is wrong and this is should be prohibited, then all of a sudden I did something wrong and I'm a bad person. I'm not saying you're a bad person. Maybe you did something wrong. We all do things that are wrong. And so it's a difficult line to walk because, of course, so many women have had abortions over the last 50 years. And so the feeling is if you pass a law prohibiting what somebody did, then all of a sudden you're saying what I did was wrong, and I don't think I'm a bad person. Yeah, it's a real political, psychological conundrum. If you weren't weeping for your nation after listening to those two, how about these two young ladies?
They can neglect them for 7 days, and if the baby dies, then they can't be held criminally liable. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I agree. I think whatever, like, helps women and helps them achieve their, like, dreams and however that needs to, like, happen is definitely acts to help that is helping all of us.
Oh, boy. You know, it would have been great if Ms. Hernandez would have followed up. Said, what if the baby was a woman? Because, you know, you said whatever helps women to achieve. Would letting a baby girl die, would that help that baby girl and women to achieve? It's always interesting, these questions that are asked, because, you know, people posture. So, you know, pro-choice, pro-abortion even, as these individuals are. But when it comes to what about a child has a disability? Would you abort? No, that sounds cruel. Oh, does it? Mm. Right? You get the it's very interesting because we've done this before. I've been a part of producing little vignettes on this, and hardline pro-abortionists. And then you say, what about gender abortion? It's a girl and we wanted a boy, so we're going to abort the girl. Oh, no, I don't support that. Oh, really? But you're pro-abortion. What about, as I just mentioned, a disability? Oh, no, I don't support that. Well, why not? You're pro-abortion. What's the problem? How does something that isn't a problem in the abstract become a problem when you attach identitarian characteristics to the child? It exposes their politics and their thoughtlessness. And by the way, this is particularly relevant, this issue, not just because of the ghoulish nature of California, where they're actually, according to Gavin Newsom, his words, building abortion infrastructure.
Well, California's preparing to be the haven for out-of-state abortions.
Right. In Illinois is right there behind them.
We're right there. We're the Midwestern version. They're the West Coast.
This is what these blue state mafia economies have become. Abortions, drugs, gambling. We just have to get prostitution legalized, and then we'll have everything we need. And, you know, there's been proposals to do just that in places like New York, as we've talked about.
It's taxable income, Dan.
That's all that matters, is revenue for the state, however you generate it. Absolutely. That's the highest order of good in a free society. No, I understand.
That comes above
That's what I understand.
Values, yes.
But there's also this matter of gubernatorial candidates in the state. And here we go again. Richard Irvin and Avery Born, Avery Born, who professes to be pro-life as a legislator, and Richard Irvin, who's
a flim-flam man.
He's pro-life, but he's not sure about
rape or incest,
limitations, and he struggled with Mike Flannery on the topic. The Illinois Right to Life questionnaire. They are not filling out.
Oh, they're going to skip it?
They sent in a statement instead of answering the actual questions on the questionnaire. That doesn't fly. They use gender-neutral terminology in their statement, which is sort of interesting. Maybe a bit of a tell. But if you don't answer the pro-life questionnaire, which includes more issues than just the life issue, because it's a pro-life, pro-family questionnaire, then I don't know how you think you're going to be the Republican nominee for governor, at least if you're going to run around and call yourself a conservative. If you want to run around like Bruce Rauner and call yourself a pro-choice and I have no social agenda, which was a big lie and was never possible, but people bought it, or Judy Bartzepinka and you're pro-choice, and that's fine. But that's not how they're characterizing themselves as conservatives, but they're not conservatives. And Avery Born is characterizing herself as a pro-lifer, but you're not a pro-lifer if you don't sign on the dotted line. And after 50 years, I would think that pro-lifers and conservatives are sophisticated enough to know when somebody is dodging them. And experience in Illinois in particular, after Mr. No Social Agenda signed one of the most permissive pro-abortion laws in the country, funding abortions, taxpayer funding of abortions all 9 months. That was Rauner. I would think that, you know, once or twice or three or four times burned, you may be a little shyer this time to embracing the same flim-flammery that you've seen before from basically the same quarter of the party. So what's happening in California has relevance to Illinois, and specifically this gubernatorial primary in Illinois, and thus the future of the Republican Party, and thus the future of the state. Tony and Steger, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, Amy, you're right. They're hiding, you know, their feelings, because even if they say that they voted for Joe Biden, but I'm not stupid, you know, so they hide it. You know, just like you said before, they really feel bad about voting for him, but they did it anyway.
Thanks, Tony. Joe, Naperville.
Yeah, first off, they couldn't ask that woman if the child was a woman, because the gender of the baby is identified when the baby makes the decision on what the gender is.
Right.
Second of all, you know, let them come out with this bill. When an idiot wants to speak, you get out of the way and let them speak. Let them paint their true colors. I wish every single state had this on the ballot, because then we would really see what idiots and how bad these people are.
Thanks, Joe. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, I'm going back to when Jeannie Ives was running against Rauner. I was trying to tell all my friends, you know, what his wife did about getting taxpayer abortions funded, and tell them not to vote for him and to vote for Jeannie, and they wouldn't listen to me. But what I really wanted to say, too, is that life begins at fertilization. That's when it starts. And these young ladies have been trained and told all this crap about, you know, you to be able to abort a baby at 9 months, all the way through the whole thing. It's just, it's sad. And there are ways to stop this, you know, whatever happened to birth control and the morning after pill? Do you remember that, Amy?
Wow.
Why can't you just go to, well, Dan, you know, I know that's not, but it would, at least it would end the pregnancy, these girls.
Yeah, would, I'm not a fan of abortifacients, but.
No, I'm not.
But
well, a lot of people are just giving their teenage daughters IUDs. Which I had never heard of before.
They were given a birth control pill.
Well, no,
they're
taking them to the doctor because they don't trust them to take their birth control. And so they're making the gynecologist put in an IUD.
Here, you want to hear something funny?
Sure.
When a mother said, yeah, my daughter's on birth control, but it's so that it can control her acne. She's not having sex. I'm like, oh, really? You think your daughter's not having, well, Amy.
Well, no. No, there's some people that take it for acne reasons.
Is there no potential
health downsides to taking the birth control pill, such that using it to control acne is a good medicinal choice?
There's other choices.
I suppose there's
lots out there.
Like OxyClean or something. I mean, I don't know, yeah. But I mean, for goodness
Noxzema,
sakes.
Dan, you want to get some Noxzema or
Proactive? What's
I mean, oh my gosh, we are so lost. Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. By the way, when life begins at conception, Mary Kay said that. You know, it's just as a reminder, Steve Jacobs, who's a scholar with Illinois Right to Life and a PhD from University of Chicago, Comparative Human Development, he did this great study that he questioned 5,577 biologists around the world, leading biologists in the academies around the world. 5,577. Profession is 3-1, left to right, at least, maybe more, going by memory. 96% life begins at fertilization. 96% life begins for fertilization. Most of them are pro-abortion, identify as Democrats, so on and so forth. But in terms of biological fact, you know, because we're all men and women of science.
Well,
these
science
days,
is paramount. No,
96% of mainly leftist biologists around the world, life begins at fertilization. Okay. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Oh, Frank.
Hey, Dan, Amy, you know, I mean, Dan, you remember this in 2010. I don't know why these different candidates aren't going out there and, you know, saying that they were Jim Edgar's chief of staff. Remember that line?
That's pretty good. You have just the right amount of jowliness. I can hear it.
Well, that was Jim Edgar's chief of staff. And I was working for a different candidate that election. I was working for Brady, and I went to all these different events, and God, I heard that thing like 25 times, and it was just like you knew it was coming, and I guess it worked for him a little bit. It got him into second place, and you know, but
yeah, he got a plum, you know, appointment, I mean, to the RTA. Kirk Dillard, we're talking about the Steam State Center from Hinsdale. Oh yeah,
yeah.
What's he up to these days?
He's got a plum appointment to the RTA.
Oh, okay.
Thanks, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So a little confab with the leading central bankers of the West, our very own Jay Powell, the Fed, Christine Lagarde, European Central Bank, and Kristalina Georgieva, the managing director of the IMF. Not since the last meeting of New York's five families have there been more kingpins in the same room. And here is what Kristalina Georgieva, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, had to say about the central bankers' response to the pandemic and the law of unintended consequences.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences. We take decisions with an objective in mind and rarely think through what may happen that is not our objective. And then we wrestle with the impact of it. Take any decision that is a massive decision, like the decision that we need to spend to support the economy. And at that time, we did recognize that may lead to too much money in circulation, too few goods, but didn't really quite think through the consequence in a way that upfront would have informed better what we do. And I subscribe entirely to what Christine said about climate shocks. We are already out of time. And the fact that whenever something hits us, we forget about this other crisis is incredibly troubling. The fact that we are, I'm sorry I'm going on here, but I'll finish in a second. We act sometimes like 8 years old playing soccer. Here is the ball, we are all at the ball, and we don't cover the rest of the field.
Uh-huh. Well, two things about that. That should not be treated as some wonderful admission. The law of unintended consequences is something that you learn about in an intro to economics course. These are the world's leading central bankers, for God's sake. The other issue is she's, on the one hand, talking about the law of unintended consequences with the funny money printing the Western central bankers did over the last 2 years. And then she moves over to talking about climate change, saying it's all over and adopting the same silly policies that Christine Lagarde and much of the West, including the Biden administration, are adopting with respect to climate vis-a-vis energy and the rest. Not much hope there. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Jim Urio, who is a Fox Business contributor and the proprietor of Brandt's restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't even know what to say. These are supposed to be
I got a few things.
Intelligent people. And I mean, one of the things, though, too, is wait a second, Ms. Georgieva. I thought all you modern monetary theorists said printing money doesn't matter.
Of course it doesn't. When she was toward the end of her little soliloquy and she said, I'm sorry, I'm going on, the only thing that popped in my head is, like, not nearly as sorry as the rest of us are. And the point is that she said the words unintended consequences three times. That's nonsense, and it's a lie. These consequences are absolutely intended. I can show you 15 different instances over the last 10 years where central bankers, where Federal Reserve central bankers talk about how we need inflation. So now let's fast forward or rewind the tape, depending what where you're looking at from, to a year ago, and they know about supply chain issues. They know about the fact that just demand has changed globally and may take a decade to change back. So they know that's happening. They know that the housing market is absolutely on fire, specifically in certain parts of the country, but generally the country as a whole. And yet they continue to buy $40 billion of mortgage-backed bonds to keep mortgages low and another $80 billion of whatever the heck else they were buying. And they continue to keep rates at zero for another year. And we're right now, it's the end of April. It feels like February, I know, in Chicago, but it's the end of April, and they still have only raised rates one quarter basis point. So there was never unintended consequences. They needed inflation. They needed, you know, five states had absolutely unsustainable debt, particularly when you factor in pension obligations. So they needed inflation. When they were worried that inflation wasn't going to be sticking around, they put their foot to the gas pedal at the same time calling it transitory. This whole thing is I'm sorry I'm going on and on and on like her, but less sorry than I was about her, if that makes any sense.
Well, how did COVID factor into this, though? Because of COVID, more money was printed to give to people to incentivize them to, stay home, really.
First of all, I don't like when we say because of COVID, because it's not because of COVID. It was because of, like, wild government overreaction. And I don't mean to be a stickler, but I worry that as we get forward in time, we'll look back and go, gosh, that darn COVID. And that darn COVID, I had COVID. It was no picnic. The reality of it is that the reaction of it by government, at every turn, they did all the wrong moves. So the damage that was done by COVID mitigation strategies particularly as it pertains to shifting demand within the supply chain. I don't know if you guys, Jim Bianco is a Chicago guy, but he wrote a great piece about, he kind of likened it in my mind, these were the exact words, like there was this system built up, let's think of it as transportation, like highways that go from Milwaukee to Chicago, you know, all these main thoroughfares, and all of a sudden you switch something, whatever it is, it could be just a minor shift of how we transport ourselves, and then all of a sudden the roads aren't built for whatever shift that is, you know, the system mirrored the demand, and then all of a sudden demand changed, work from home began. So the COVID mitigation strategy is a huge deal, and it easily could take 10 years to figure out the supply chain thing. Both my brothers are in the chip industry, not the eating chip industry, the electronic chip industry, and both of them say these problems about supply chip shortages are unbelievable.
Well, and the other thing too with these central bankers is, you know, there's all this talk now about winding down and, you know, coming out of the run up to their $9 trillion balance sheet. Well, you know, the idea, you know, are they're doing it just right. They've got to, you know, thread the needle here. Maybe they're being a little bit too aggressive right now. It's like they're doing like, you know, 1%, not even a month in terms of winding down. They have no idea what they're doing.
I think they have no idea what they're doing either, and I think they're in a really, really tough spot. I know, and they're to call them, I think, politically motivated half-wits is being somewhat generous, and the reality of it is all you have to look at is the day after, I think it was a day or two after, that Jerome Powell was reappointed, where he didn't have to worry about his job anymore. That's the day that he decided that inflation was a problem. So that's just such a convenient flip-flop for him to be uber dovish while he's, because the government always loves easy money, and, you know, until it's too easy. And he should have been the adult in the room, and he wasn't.
I want to read you an observation from a guy whose rants I read, this guy Joel Ross, who's a, you know, one of these financial guys who's got newsletters and stuff. But he's followed by a lot of people that we both know that are sophisticated in the space. He writes, "The big government finance party is over. Home prices will soon follow down. Look at the multiples. Look at the multiples home building stocks sell at, very low. The canary is not chirping, it's screaming. While it's true there's still huge pent-up demand for home, there's not the affordability needed to continue to drive sales. Mortgage rates now are 5%. Rents in many markets shot up to reach unaffordable levels. So I foresee rent stabilizing this year, and a material slowdown in housing always results in a recession or near recession, which he thinks could come as soon as the end of this year."
I agree with the recession thesis. And it's really hard to say that when the labor market is still basically on fire, but I definitely believe in the recession thesis. As far as him saying that home prices are going, I don't know what the wording was exactly, head lower. I don't believe that part, because we all in our heads think back to 2006, 7, and 8, where you know, home prices imploded. The situation there, the bubble that they created there, filtered down to a much different level of participation, meaning when you are sitting at Thanksgiving dinner and your electrician brother-in-law, I don't know if I've said this metaphor before, and I'm going to say it again, when your electrician brother-in-law talks about the four homes he owns, that he's flipping them, that's when you know that the mortgage margin has built up into an unsustainable level. Like right now, remember, I believe it was a fifth of the houses that were bought over the last 2 years were bought by hedge funds, specifically see BlackRock here. By the way, borrowing money at 0% and right, buying up the housing stock. So, you know, young kids trying to buy their first home can't, which is a separate discussion, but absolutely absurd. But the notion that just because rates are going up, all of a sudden home prices are going to lose 20%, I don't believe that yet. I just think they're going to stop going higher.
Give us your take on the impact of the successful Musk takeover bid on Twitter, and also something he said we were talking about a little bit earlier in the show at a TED conference earlier this month in Canada, talking about, you know, this isn't about making money, this is about establishing a beachhead for free speech, words to that effect. Well, with you know, the private equity concerns like Thoma Bravo involved in this deal and Morgan Stanley involved in this, it's going to have to be about making money, and it's going to have to be about making Twitter worth more north of $44 billion.
Yeah, and I think he believes that too. I think the thing about not making money is a soundbite to try to really, you know, pitch Twitter as a place for open dialogue. And I hate when people throw around free speech. Free speech is a legal term. He means open dialogue and not having your opponents silent. Which, something that amazes me is that there's just this morning in the New York Times talking about how, you know, bad it is for these billionaires, for this billionaire to be control the platform. And I just want to go back and find the article when Jeff Bezos took over the Washington Post, if they said that, because the answer to that is no, they didn't, because the media has zero problem with people squashing the other side if it's their side they stand with. So, yeah, I'm hoping that – I don't believe that Musk is the right guy to be monitoring the forum. I just believe he's better than the current people.
So do you – I mean, you know, your read on him, do you think that he is going to – inspire some revolution in thinking in the big tech sector?
I certainly hope so. Remember, you said too that the deal went through. It didn't actually go through. I mean, the stock's trading right now at $52. The offer is $54.20. So the stock is telling us right now that it's probably going through, but it's still 4% under the offer price. So the way I kind of put that, you know, is like, if you buy it at 52, what are the odds it goes to 54.20, and what are the odds it goes back to the high 30s, which is where in February? So I think the market is telling me that there's a 1 in 7 chance that the deal doesn't happen. Remember, this isn't they just agreed to recommend the deal to shareholders. Plus, there's potential regulatory hurdles, which I can't see, but that doesn't
right.
mean they're not out there. Someone won't concoct them.
Yeah,
but
fair point.
I think it's an enormous deal. I think this is, to me, I was just very celebratory about it. And again, I reiterate, I don't think he's the perfect owner. He's just miles better than the people who were.
Jim Urio, Fox Business analyst, contributor, and the proprietor of Brandt's in Palatine, the best burger in town. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
You didn't say that with enough conviction. You said
that.
Yeah,
you kind of like, it's like afterthought.
You know,
yeah.
What is that all about?
Well, it's the best burger, but also I like the tacos. I like the ribs. The ribs are good.
Every time I say you have the best burger in town, and it is a good burger, and I do like the ribs. I had the ribs, but... Every time I get, then it's not that I don't believe it. I get blowback from other friends that have restaurants who have burgers. So why don't you say I have the best burger in town?
You have the best burger in the North.
I'm trying to make everybody happy, Jim.
I know, I know. I just, you could hear it in your voice. I just tell the people to try for themselves.
That's exactly, exactly. Go to Brandt's and find out. There you go.
It's in Palatine off of Northwest Highway, right?
Yes, exactly.
Thank you. See, I know what I'm doing.
Perfect.
And Jim joined us on our turnkey Top Pro Answer Line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Jen Psaki was asked about this 22-year-old Texas National Guardsman who died at the border trying to rescue people coming into this country illegally, and I believe they were smuggling drugs.
It was two of them that died, yeah.
And the question put to her by Fox News' Jackie Heinrich is, does the Biden administration bear any responsibility for that National Guardsman's death?
Does the White House feel any responsibility for his death, given that there's reporting that he lost his life allegedly trying to save two migrants who were smuggling drugs? This is a problem that, you know, the administration has been facing for some time and is obviously, as we've been discussing, getting some criticism on. Does the White House feel at all responsible, and what more can you offer to people who, you know, are on the border, in border communities, who are experiencing loss and trials like this?
Well, I, of course, we are mourning the loss of his life, and we are grateful for the work of every National Guardsman. I would note that the National Guard work for the states, and so he is an employee of the Texas National Guard, and his efforts and his operation were directed by there, not by the federal government.
Oh, my gosh. Passing it the buck.
Well, Jen, why did Governor Abbott feel the need to have to deploy the National Guard to do border control work? And then she went on to criticize Trump for attempting to build a wall rather than doing the smart enhanced security that the Biden administration has proposed.
Oh, really? That's working out very well, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, you see parts of the wall that are, you know, the materials, some of the materials still left, and the walls there, and people just walking through that area.
1 million illegal crossings so far this fiscal year after 2 million last year. It's going very well, smarter and better. Jason Johnson joins us now, former deputy commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department, currently president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Jason, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, Amy. Good to be with you.
What do you think about Ms. Psaki's answer to the death of that guardsman?
It's typical what you come to expect from the administration. It's sort of bob and weave, avoid responsibility for everything. I mean, even the fact that she saw it necessary to point out that the Texas National Guard is under the direction of the Texas governor it's disrespectful, frankly, because the question is, had nothing to do with that. And obviously the reason that the Texas National Guard has to be deployed there is because of this administration's policies. And that was what the question was.
And we talked about this, was it last week, where the Border Patrol agents that were accused of whipping Haitian migrants were finally cleared about 7 months after Mayorkas said the investigation would be complete. But it's the old Ray Donovan line, where do they go to get their reputations back, right?
Exactly. I wrote an op-ed last week in response to that, because it's exactly right. You know, if you recall, Biden himself condemned the actions of those agents without knowing what exactly those actions were. So too did other high-ranking members of the administration. They launched an investigation, which is fine, because investigation is how we find out, you know, what the truth is. Now we've got the truth. Those Border Patrol agents were doing exactly what they were supposed to do. They didn't do anything wrong. They didn't whip anyone. And there's no reaction from the White House. There's no, hey, sorry about that, these guys actually were doing their jobs. Nothing. So you're exactly right. Where do they go to get the reputations back? And there's no answer.
Well, have they allowed them to ride horses again in that area? I mean, because, you know, they were whipping the horses, not the Haitians at the time. And they took the horses away from them, and they took them, put them on desk duty.
Yeah. Well, who knows? I mean, this administration is so antithetical to law enforcement, so antithetical to protecting our borders, that there's just no answer for that, and they're not going to answer. And this isn't the only, you know, this isn't the only circumstance in which they've shown their bias against law enforcement, prejudging cases, failing to protect federal law enforcement officers in a variety of ways. So no answer for that. It's clear that at that particular Border Patrol station, mounted Border Patrol agents is a key advantage there to help protect the border. But if you don't want to protect the border, I guess there's no need to deploy agents in that way. And so they probably will not.
You had a couple of dozen members of Congress, just sticking on the border for a second, sign a letter to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Actually, more than 50, questioning his ability to do his job, and, you know, restating what we all understand to be true about the situation at the border. Your actions have willingly endangered American citizens, undermined the rule of law and our nation's sovereignty, among other things. Have the Republicans, whether they're border state governors or members of Congress, in your estimation, have they been aggressive enough in pursuing the publicization of what's happening at the border?
Perhaps not, but you know, I think there are just limited media channels that are willing to carry the Republican or really the American side of this story. We all know which one or two or three will, and the rest of them will not. And so, I think you can always say not enough has been done to really get the truth out, but it's tough when all of the social media companies, until, you know, perhaps now Twitter won't censor messages, and many of the mainstream media organizations won't carry the message either. It becomes, you know, somewhat difficult.
Christopher Wray, FBI director, was on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, covered a range of topics, and also didn't cover a lot of topics that should have been covered for all kinds of obvious reasons, but I digress. One of them is violent crime in mainly America's urban centers. And he talked about how the FBI works with state and local, how he said they arrested something like 15,000 gang bangers in the last calendar year. What's your assessment of the job that Ray is doing and that FBI is doing in consultation with state and local, especially as a former local officer? Or is that sort of, an unfair lens through which to look at this because crime control is really mainly a local issue?
Yeah, I think it's the latter, Dan. I think crime control is largely a local responsibility, and I don't think we can, in any administration, I don't think we can expect the FBI to go into cities and fix locally created problems, and that's exactly what they are. My experience has been the FBI and the other federal law enforcement agencies, again, regardless of administration, on the ground, they're good partners. They don't have the, they bring technical capabilities. They don't bring huge numbers, which is really what's needed. They don't bring the ability to prosecute large amounts of violent criminals. They can cherry pick some for the federal court, but they can't handle large numbers. And that's just understood. But when you have local officials who are intentionally obstructing the criminal justice process, I just don't think you can expect the federal government to come in and clean that up. And I know you have that in Chicago. We have that in Baltimore, in a city that I'm, very familiar with, and in so many other cities across the country, where there just is no will by local officials to do what's right and to get the problem under control.
Well, in San Francisco, voters are fighting back. They want to recall the DA there, Bowdoin, in June. So that's promising, don't you think?
I do. And it's a remarkable situation where you even have the mayor of a city like San Francisco pushing back, being vocal about her displeasure with Bowdoin, who is an extreme example. But there are many, many others, including Larry Krasner in Philly, Marilyn Mosby, Kim Fox there in Chicago, and so many others. But, yeah, I think that's very encouraging. I there are a few other cities where I think there's some pushback. But on the other side of that coin, Marilyn Mosby, he's under federal indictment. Of course, Baltimore's failed state's attorney. She's under federal indictment, but she's leading in the polls for her reelection this year. So that's a discouraging story.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a piece in The Atlantic about the exodus from downtowns by Derek Thompson. This is not coming from a conservative perspective, but the numbers are the numbers. And the numbers in 2021, the top 20 largest metropolitan areas in America lost a combined almost 1 million people. So the flight from big city America, and yes, part of that is remote working and so on and so forth. But if you were in a nice place to live and you still could work from home, then maybe you would stay there. There's something else happening. There's another variable happening. And it seems to me, based on the opinion polling in terms of what issues are most important to Americans, and you see this even in big blue cities and big blue states, that violent crime is it. That's really what it explains to a significant extent why you see a flight from downtown America.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a problem that is going to continue to grow, because a lot of the folks that are leaving, whether it's for that reason, and I think you're right, it's largely because of crime or lack of public safety. There's also issues with schools, and there's other concerns, high taxes and what have you. But the people who are leaving are largely the ones who are picking up the tab. They're at the higher end of the socioeconomic spectrum. They're not the people that are consuming a lot of government services. And so what's going to happen now is they're going to have to find other ways to keep up that revenue, and they're going to do it by tax increases by who remains. And it's just going to be a cycle that's going to drive people out of cities in the future. And so challenges ahead for cities, no question about it. Part may be driven by remote work, but you're right. I think it's largely a question of public safety.
As a former deputy commissioner, of the Baltimore Police Department, what we learned by watching 60 Minutes again, too, and just reading that 73 police officers were shot last year, one about every 5 days, and most of them were ambushed just because they were wearing the badge. Are those numbers shocking to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is, you know, law enforcement officers have always understood that they're going to face danger. They're going to respond to dangerous situations that are in progress. They're going to confront dangerous people. But if, you know, some of these cases, you know, as you point out, some of these are ambushes. These are police officers sitting in their car completing a police report, and somebody sneaks up on them and shoots them. These are police officers sitting in a restaurant trying to have a meal with a colleague, and someone comes in and just, you know, unexpectedly shoots them. And it's all because of the way law enforcement officers are portrayed in our culture, in popular media, in social media. People have been exposed to a message that the predictable consequence of that message is that people will direct violence toward police officers. And it's shameful, it's sad, it's tragic, and it really, really has to change.
Do you think politicians who support Black Lives Matter, that is a position that should disqualify them from public office?
Yes. I mean, I think I share the same view as you and many of your listeners that the idea that Black Lives Matter is an appropriate one. The organization Black Lives Matter is a shakedown for money, a successful shakedown for money. That just promotes a Marxist philosophy, doesn't do anything to help the Black community as it's supposed to. And, supporting that organization, it should be a disqualifier.
Jason Johnson, former Deputy Commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department, currently President of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Jason Johnson, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, speaking of running. Pocahontas was asked on Meet the Press over the weekend if she's
a marathoner.
No, if she's considering running for president in 2024.
Oh, so is Bernie Sanders.
And
bring out the oldies.
I mean, honestly, listen to Warren.
By himself.
Senator Warren, we learned this week in a leaked memo that Bernie Sanders is not ruling out a run in 2024. If President Biden decides he's not running, we want to be very clear. President Biden has said he's absolutely running. Here you are out with this op-ed. Are you ruling out a run in 2024 should President Biden decide he's not going to make another go?
I'm not running for president in 2024. I'm running for Senate. President Biden is running for re-election
in
2024.
So would you rule it out, Senator?
I'm supporting him.
Would you rule it out?
You can ask it any way you want, but I'm going to say the same thing. President Biden is running in 2024, and I'm supporting him.
Okay.
Cheerfully.
Great. I hope you're right. I hope he is. It is amazing, though. Bernie Sanders is 80 right now. She's 72. Mm-hmm. Biden's 79. I mean, and look, on the other side, McConnell's 80, Trump's 74. I mean, you know, good grief. But, hey, look,
They have an old bench, Dan.
Hey, I'm going to take Pocahontas at her word. That's the first time I've ever been able to do that Biden is running and she's supporting him, and I'm supporting her, supporting him, running for re-election in 2024. How's that?
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
I said, when. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints.com, all things Illinois. Policy related, and the summer of joy is off to a bit of a slow start. Summer of Joy, that's the term that Lori Lightfoot has given to the forthcoming summer. And yesterday, after 8 people were murdered and 42 people were shot this weekend, you had 2 guys shot and killed in Humboldt Park 20 minutes apart.
Uh-huh. I mean, it's just, it's a war zone out there. I don't know how else to describe it. Just sheer chaos. And one lady who lives in Boys Town, because not only was downtown, all the fights broke out at the Bean, and then it spilled onto Michigan Avenue, but there was incidents in Boys Town where people were just jumping on top of cars that were stopped on Halstead Street at a stop sign. And I just wanted you to hear this woman, because this is such a typical Chicagoan. Her reaction when asked about the rising crime in her neighborhood.
This is a neighborhood. This is a street with a lot of bars, so you can expect like a little rowdiness on a Saturday night. That's true, but not that kind of rowdiness. And I do get a little scared, so I try to go home early and, you know, pretend like none of this even exists.
Pretend like none of this even exists. Is that the perfect description of a Chicagoan? They pretend like COVID lockdowns don't exist. Rising property taxes don't exist. You know, it's just,
yeah, the willful blindness.
Right.
No, I get it. We also had, by the way, this spills out into the suburbs too, armed carjacking outside the Neiman Marcus at Oakbrook Mall.
That's right.
After the shooting there last year. Dangerous times in and around Chicago. For more on this, let's welcome Ted Dabrowski. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. How are you guys doing?
Morning. One of the contributors to Wire Points is Matt Rosenberg, and he wrote a piece this week about the high-risk offenders in Cook County, the repeat offenders. You know, the 16 people, for example, that have been charged with killing or attempting to kill someone while they were awaiting trial for killing or attempting to kill someone.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We were going through that list yesterday as we put this together, and yeah, you've got people with multiple convictions who then are on bail for some other heinous crime, and they go out and create another heinous crime, or at least they're allegedly. I guess I should use the word allegedly. And, you know, it's case after case after case. And we're talking about murders. We're talking about attempted murders. And, you know, the judges in Illinois can use judgment if they deem a high risk, a flight risk, or a risk to people or the community. They can order these alleged perpetrators to be held without bail, and yet they don't. And, you know, I think what we're saying is, look, it's time to use a little bit more discretion here, or maybe a lot more discretion. There's plenty of people who it seems, as you read this, are obvious candidates for being held without bail.
And what's Kim Fox doing? That went during the worst, most, you know, deadly weekend so far this year. What does she do? She's on a plane to L.A. for some reason. You know, she doesn't care. I think she sleeps at night just fine because nothing people say is going to change her mind. So in San Francisco, they're trying to voters are planning to recall their D.A. there. Do you ever see that happening? Like what would be the breaking point for people living in Cook County?
Yeah, I don't know, you know, about that. I mean, you just look at these examples, and I think, you know, CWB does a really good job bringing this out. But, you know, look at the examples of you know, this one 21-year-old who had 3 prior felony convictions was charged with first-degree murder and 26 other felonies in March. And he was out on bond for a $500 bond on a pending felony weapons charge. And he went on a just a victim spree, 13 different victims with a baseball bat, and he kills a father hanging Christmas lights. You know, as these stories get out there, this is not a random story. This is one of several. And we had over 50 of those, I think it was, in 2020, another 71 similar type stories in 2021. You know, how much longer can we continue to allow, you know, these high-risk people who have a long history of felonies to continue to be on the streets with electric monitoring or on some kind of on a bail? It's just, you know, it's the worst marketing we can do for Chicago if we're trying to attract people and get back to normal.
Yeah, tourists. What tourists are going to come? I mean, that people are saying, oh, there's flash mob. My cop friend told me there was almost 500 people that took over Millennium Park and were by the Bean yesterday or last Saturday night.
Yeah, I mean, it's frightening when you start to have crowds, flash crowds like that take over. I know we're talking, Dan, you're talking, and Amy, you guys are talking about the big cities and the difficulty of attracting people or keeping its people. Well, this is a very fast way to lose your taxpayers, your biggest taxpayers. There's a lot of other places to live, as we know, and we've seen that in all the studies.
I wanted to get your reaction to something else that's in the news in Florida, specifically, obviously, the special purpose tax district that Disney enjoyed until recently, that Reedy Creek District. It was a good piece by Judge Glock in the Wall Street Journal on it this week, talking about this more generally. He's at the Cicero Institute. 38,000 such special purpose districts around the country, which is twice the number of cities. And we know about this in Illinois. Illinois has more units of government than any state in the nation, despite being only the fifth most populous, more elected officials than any state in the nation, despite being the fifth most populous. And probably that says something about why it's one of the worst governed states in American history. But 38,000 such entities, and we know about that in Cook County. How long did it take to get rid of the tuberculosis district? We have got the mosquito abatement district, these layers of government and special purpose tax districts. Maybe what happened to Disney in Florida will spark a larger conversation about said layers.
Well, I think it should. You know, those of us who follow this stuff realize just how, first of all, how lucrative it is to have all these different units of government. There's a lot of people enriching themselves from it. They all have boards. They all have, you know, special taxation powers. They get special money from the state, or, you know, they don't deserve to exist. And what they also do is they create a huge amount of overlap. People don't realize in Illinois that all these units of government, they're really overlapping. And what they do is they suck up money and bring the private sector down, because the private sector is what funds it. And it enriches the public sector. So I think this Disney stuff was really good news, in the sense that, you know, here's a very good example of a company getting massive breaks. This is not a small company getting massive breaks, massive tax benefits, all kinds of powers. And it's the same thing that happens in Illinois. Just look at these school districts and these superintendents and these overlapping units of government all over the place.
And township, you know, the municipal, township, county, you know, on and on, right.
You know, Dan, I did a study of, we looked at all the libraries and, you know, how many libraries there are that you could have consolidation of libraries. You could do all kinds of stuff, but and instead you've got all these boards and you know, head of libraries making tons of money. It's duplicative and wasteful for taxpayers.
Speaking of the public sector, your colleague over at WirePoints, Mark Lennon, had a good piece about this Amendment 1 question that's on the November ballot here in Illinois. The ballot question reads as follows. Employees shall have the fundamental right to organize and to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing to protect their economic welfare. No law shall be passed that interferes with, negates, or diminishes the right of employees to organize and bargain collectively over terms and conditions of their employment. Well, wait a second. I support the right of workers to collectively bargain if they so choose. So what's the problem with this Amendment 1?
No, that's fascinating. There's a couple of things. And, you know, Mark wrote, and I think it might be true, this thing might be more important than who you vote for governor or any other elected office in Illinois. What this thing does is it does two things. It enshrines these collective bargaining rights into the Constitution. And it creates kind of a new right for workers, for public workers and private workers, a new right to organize. And it also adds new language, something like, you know, it protects your economic welfare. Well, my gosh, think about that. If that's in the Constitution overrides all laws. And so if groups start to organize, imagine you have a small company and the people there want to organize. Next thing you know, they're suing you over their economic welfare. Nobody knows what that means, how it's defined. We could have our whole private sector just wrapped up in muck, and nobody can figure out what's going on because, you know, workers everywhere are protecting their economic welfare. That's number one. So it mucks up the private sector. Number two, gosh, if you know anything about Illinois, is that the unions have the most powers, or almost the biggest powers in the country, to organize and negotiate and bargain and strike. We're going to put that in the Constitution. Can you imagine ever trying to bring down property taxes if we can't reform costs ever? So it's impossible to think of this thing as being anything positive for Illinois. I think it would just be the nail in the coffin.
Whose idea was to put that on the ballot, huh?
The public sector unions, of course. I mean, right, so what do we have? $313 billion in unfunded public sector pension debt. And the argument from the public sector unions and the politicians they own is, hey, you know, we just want a seat at the table. We just want to protect workers' rights. We just want a fair deal.
I think what nobody realizes, well, there's a lot of people who would be very empathetic to that. But you have to understand that when they get all the power, the people that lose power are the ordinary, you know, ordinary Jane and Joe six pack. They don't have powers. Nobody gives, Jane and Joe six pack, long term government contracts and guaranteed pensions and automatic cost of living adjustments and all those things. Nobody gets that. So the more power they accrue and the more power that ordinary Illinois give to the unions, the more people are losing out. And they may not understand what they're doing to themselves, but our goal is to help everybody understand what Amendment 1 is and how bad it is for Illinois.
Well, and as I think both of us have often said, you mentioned property taxes. Understand in Illinois, this is like the fundamental understanding. If you don't get this, then you don't get anything. And if you don't think this is important, then you're lost. You don't own your home. You don't own property in Illinois. Your property is collateral for somebody else's guaranteed seven-figure pension. That's how it works.
You can't be more right. It's every time you look at every one of these. We just did a piece on the new laws that have been passed in the last couple of years. You know, Governor Pritzker promised to lower property taxes. He talked about the too many units of government and these guaranteed levy increases that cities put on every single, school districts as well, put on every year. Well, he did nothing about that. But actually, if you look at all the laws he passed, they all increase pensions and costs. And you're absolutely right. We pay the highest property taxes in the country, according to a new report by Adam. According to Tax Foundation, we're the second highest in the country. Yeah. And our property tax levels are multiples of what they are in the states with lower property taxes.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
All right.
Dan and Amy, there is a new sexuality choice.
Yeah.
That's an option.
I was going to ask you about that. The fictosexuals?
Fictosexual.
What is that?
Well, let me tell you a little romantic story to illustrate it.
Well, wait. Can we have romantic music, Justin, please? I mean, this man is a professional. He needs to be treated as such.
In almost every way.
Yes.
Akiko Kondo is an ordinary Japanese man. He's pleasant, easy to talk to. He has friends and a steady job and wears a suit and tie to work. There's just one exception. Mr. Kondo is married to a fictional character. His beloved Miku is a turquoise-haired, computer-synthesized pop singer who has toured with Lady Gaga and starred in video games. After a decade-long relationship, one that Mr. Kondo said pulled him out of a deep depression, he held a small, unofficial wedding ceremony in Tokyo in 2018. Miku wore white, of course, and he was in matching tuxedo. In Miku, Mr. Kondo has found love, inspiration, and solace, he says. He and his assortment of Miku dolls eat, sleep, and watch movies together. Sometimes they sneak off on romantic getaways, posting photos on Instagram. He knows people think it's strange. He hopes he'll grow out of it. And he knows Miku isn't real, but his feelings for her are real. When we're together, she makes me smile. Mm-hmm. In that sense, she's real.
Because she's a wife who doesn't talk or nag.
Fictosexual. What pop singer would you marry? Like the doll version of a pop singer. I was just trying to think of that when I'm reading the story. I'm thinking
Justin Bieber before the tattoo.
Not for me. But maybe for you. I was thinking, back when I was coming of age. I mean, it's hard to go wrong with Samantha Fox. Remember her?
Oh yeah, Samantha Fox.
She could sing that to me, the doll version. Yeah.
Touch me now.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm going to have to download that now on my iTunes.
I don't know. I mean, again, that would be Samantha Fox. My doll would be the younger Samantha Fox because now she's like 100
uh-huh.
or 56. What's the difference?
Oh, easy.
All right.
Okay, I know you guys age better than the ladies.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and a quick little history lesson, history of man in 20 seconds or less.
Okay.
Cool. And then the dinosaurs came, but they got too big and fat, so they all died and they turned into oil. And then the Arabs came and they bought Mercedes-Benzes. And Prince Charles started wearing all of Lady Di's clothes. I couldn't believe it. He took her best summer dress out of the closet and he put it on and went to town.
Yeah, oh, and then men started wearing pea hats and now they're getting plastic surgery. And now there are very few men left. This from a plastic surgeon writing in Newsweek. Yeah, it still exists.
I just read that article. That's so funny.
Dr. Richard Westrick talking about his time as a plastic surgeon, nearly two decades. When I was training 20 years ago, there were a lot of lectures in plastic surgery about the problem patients and red flags to be aware of. At the time, simply being a male was considered a red flag. They were seen as potentially difficult patients, uncertainty about what their motivation was, whether we'd be able to make them happy. There was a thought that men were maybe doing plastic surgery for external factors, meaning more acting roles, promotion at work, get your wife to love you more, those external factors that are red flags.
Oh, it's to pick up the younger ladies, but okay.
To the ethical plastic surgeon.
Oh, all right, back then.
He writes... That he does rhinoplasty.
Mm-hmm.
There are more men now coming in for cosmetic surgery. While men used to represent 5% of my patients, now they're 20 to 30%. In the non-surgical realm, Botox and fillers, men are still in a minority, but I've seen an increase in that as well.
Are you ready to Botox? Because you're turning 50 this Friday. Or do you want fillers?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you think about that, men slowly turning into women? And although that's increased in pace in recent years, I think donning the pea hats was perhaps a watershed moment.
Well, I was in the news business, so men were getting... procedures well, yeah. long before other men.
No.
Other
well,
men were.
Well, in the TV news business, the men
right.
turned into women, I mean, two or three generations ago.
Don Lemon told me the best thing he ever did was tuck his ears back because his ears used to stick out. And then once he tucked them back, he said he was getting offers all over the place.
Don Lemon is an example of a man in the news business, is he?
I'm just telling you.
Uh-huh. That's my point. Thank you for making my point for me.
I used to work with him. He told me that. And I thought that, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Ron Majors, what did he have done?
No, nothing. Honestly, I don't think the man. No, of course he didn't have anything. It's good for men to be old in the news business. You know, gives them credibility.
More men coming in for eyelid lifts,
mm-hmm.
neck lifts,
ooh.
Facial lipo. Tightening. There aren't many men asking for lip augmentation.
Yet.
Don Lemon may be an exception. More are coming in for those Botox and those fillers that are so popular. They typically don't want brow lifts or heavy forehead Botox, Pelosi style.
Mm-hmm.
They're more accepting of line retention. The whole increase in men getting these procedures for presentation purposes. I mean, I can understand if it's a health thing. I don't know if I call it like a lap band, like cosmetic surgery, although I suppose it can be Jesse Jackson Jr. But I'm thinking about some of these other procedures that are more associated with starlets and aging newscastresses and whatnot.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 6-4-6-3-6, type in DA, then a quick comment. What procedures should Dan have done for his 50th?
I'm working with all original equipment here. I'm happy to tell you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So those are real.
Yeah.
To you.
Yeah, and they're up, and my eyes up are up here. Yeah.
No, but yeah. A lot of people are getting Botox, and a lot, you know, I had lower eyelid surgery when I was 26 years old.
Why?
Because what's his name? He used to anchor with Jackie Bang, Robert Jordan.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Sure.
So he had really bad bags under his eyes, and he and I were talking about it because I saw him a few weeks. I don't know. We saw each other, and then we were in another scene.
He had bad bags under his eyes, so you got the surgery?
No, so I said, well, I said to him, God, you look 30 years younger. And he told me about this, you know, Dr. Drolis. And
oh, sure.
So I went to see Dr. Drolis, and I know
good.
Other people did. And because there is no light in the world or makeup that could cover your bags or hide them. And so I got it done at 26, and they're still going strong ever since.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
keep
but
going.
It was,
what else?
No, Dan, I don't want to tell you about my breast augmentations. I did that because of back pain.
Uh-huh.
So I had to, you know,
uh-huh.
get that done. But yeah, I Botox here and there.
I like the guys that get calf implants. Have you heard this?
No, that used to be, seriously, that used to be the number one surgery for men.
Like the women who get butt implants because they want to look like a Kardashian or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
It's disgusting. But yeah, men are very, for some reason, they think women care about their calves. Nobody cares about your calves. I'm sorry. If they're skinny, who cares?
Nobody
Michael
cares
Jordan that, has cat doesn't have calves. Who cares?
Nobody cares about your looks, period. They don't care. They care about, you know, other things like the size of your, you know, bank
heart
account.
Or your bank. Oh, that's right. In Florida, I think they care more about the size of your bank account.
Oh, it's that's a Florida phenomenon, is it? Yeah, okay. Yeah. But
see, I stopped people harassing me and, you know,
let's
sexually
pretend,
harassing me when
let's
I kept
pretend,
them in a van.
Let's pretend you've never been, you know, on the Gold Coast. Okay.
No,
yeah.
Okay. That's right. I have seen people in action, but I don't partake in that.
Chris in Elmwood Park.
Hi. This isn't about plastic surgery, but it is about the changes in men. I was at the nail salon,
and a
man came in with his three sons, 9, you know, and under, and they all got manicures.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
the world is changing.
No, the world is changing.
Thanks,
I used to
Chris.
Take my sons to get manicures, pedicures. They loved it because it was relaxing and somebody cut their toenails for them because I didn't want to do it. But no, I noticed whenever I go and get a manicure, there's 8 out of 10 times there's always a man there getting a manicure or a pedicure.
Yeah, another sign of the apocalypse, sign of the end of man.
Wait, you've never gotten a manicure or pedicure?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, I'm getting you a mani and pedi for your 50th.
You'll love it.
They'll slice that dead skin off the bottom of your feet.
I'm not. How do you know if there's dead skin on the bottom of my
feet? Because
I don't show the bottom of my feet to just anybody. I always wear closed toe footwear because I'm a man. I don't wear flip flops. I don't wear sandals. Yeah, no, I'm not down for any of that. No.
I bet Governor Pritzker gets mani-pedis. I bet he does.
Well, he physically cannot cut his own toenails.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But I will tell you this. I will, you know, I will risk engendering a backlash. Mm-hmm. I men who get plastic surgery, I mean, I'm talking about cosmetic surgery. I'm not talking about, like, you know, my nose got broken or I was in a car accident. You know, cosmetic surgery for appearance sake, it's terrible. And it, by the way, it usually looks terrible, and that doesn't even include all the, you know, Hollywood horror stories of plastic surgery going
wrong.
You know
who had a great plastic surgeon? Chet Kopick. He had it done a few times.
May he rest in peace.
I know, but I remember him was being very open with me about it, and I noticed a difference, and I thought he looked great.
Yeah.
I did. Mike Scott, have you ever gotten a manicure pedicure? Mike? Mike's not listening.
Yeah,
Mike's
of course not. Why
you're
would you listen to this nonsense?
At our Matrix Home Solutions.
By the way, I also include, and by the way, in this, I also include if you get an alfalfa field planted in your forehead like Joe Biden.
Really?
Yeah.
Mike's not doing that.
That's a no-go. Grant in Rockford, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, you guys. Real quick, I work on a farm, Amy, and if my hands aren't bleeding, I didn't do my job right. There's no mani-pedis where I am, but anyway, this is all just indicative of what you always say, Dan, the men without chests and these people who just think, oh, I can change how I look. I feel different today and be a whole different person. And no, you're still the same ugly person on the inside. Yeah, and Dan, please no butt implants in seedy motels. Those don't usually turn out very well.
All right. I'll pass on the butt implants. Thanks, Grant.
I met a man once. Was that the Madonna concert? I can't remember, but
that was no man.
No, he was this big. He was so skinny, and he thought that he had a little, like, muffin top thing going on, and he was going in to get that taken care of, or liposuction. I said, well, if any doctor is doing that to you, they're just doing that for money, because there was nothing there.
This is a sad story.
I think they'll feel better, you know, if they get it done.
I hate to break it to Sox fans. This is a very sad story.
Oh, what?
Now I regret even raising this topic.
Oh, no, what happened?
There are no heroes anymore. That's what happened, Miss Jacobson.
What?
No heroes. My wife once walked by a salon in Hinsdale in front of a window, getting a manicure and looking sheepish. Hall of Famer Jim Thome.
Oh.
That Jim Thome Park in Hinsdale, that his name should be stripped from that park.
Oh, no. Now he's gone and done it.
Oh, Jim. He's from Peoria. What does he know about man? See, this is what happens. You move to the big city, or Peoria area. I can't remember exactly where, but he's from downstate. You move to the big city, and you become a chick.
Oh, boy.
Jim Thome. Say it ain't so, Jim.
Text
Eduardo
lines are
Midway.
Open too. Yes.
Yeah, good morning. I wouldn't get any of that stuff, manicures, facials, or anything like that. But I do want to see the men wearing more ties. I see a lot of them, they just have the jacket and, you know, dress slacks, but no tie. I noticed that.
Yeah, I haven't seen a tie in months.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Eduardo.
When was the last time you saw a tie?
I mean, see them all the time because, you know, after 5 o'clock, I'm in a tuxedo because I'm not a farmer.
I used to like when men would wear, you know, dress up for church, but that's, those days are long gone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Terry in Port Charlotte, Florida.
Hey, hi. Dan.
Hi, Terry.
Good to hear you guys, Amy.
Hi.
And my husband, he's a Marine, not an active Marine, but mm-hmm. he's 70 years old and he gets a manicure or a pedicure every month.
Good for
really?
Him. As he should.
Like, he calls them, like, Flintstone feet if he doesn't get it, you know?
I wonder, Terry, if your husband has something else he needs to tell
Dan.
You. I'm kidding. Of course,
no,
I'm kidding.
No.
He's a Marine. He's a 70-year-old Marine. So when did he start doing pedicures? It certainly wasn't in the service.
Oh, shoot.
Oh, no. I wanted to hear more
about
it. Well,
we got a text message. Hey, Dan and Amy, just a pedicure, no paint. It's just a foot massage. And that's true. It's so relaxing.
No,
Dan,
No.
And then seriously, they
it's
shave
not a,
the
it's not just
dead
a foot
skin
massage.
Off the ankle and on the balls of your foot. And if not, that stuff's going to build up over time. It's going to calcify, and you could be able to give it.
That's
an
the
extra
only place.
Inch.
That's the only place you're going to still have balls is your feet if you continue getting pedicures. Point is this: you want a massage? Then go to a masseuse.
All right. Have you ever
you get the full
massage?
Body massage?
Oh,
yes.
Wait, didn't I get you a massage in Los Cabos?
No.
I thought we got you a massage.
No, I got me a massage.
Well, we lined it up.
No,
because you'd never had a massage
right.
before.
You pointed
so
me to
bit.
Where the spa was.
Yes, I guess
you contributed in that way. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a massage. That's an athletic event.
Oh, really?
You know, improving your flexibility, and that's not a cosmetic event.
Okay.
Yeah. Mike in Deerfield.
Yeah. Hi, Dan and Amy. I have teenage daughters, and one of them was just obsessed with how blonde my eyebrows were, like they're transparent. So she begged me to get my eyebrows dyed. So I went with her. I acquiesced, and I looked like Eugene Levy or Fred Trump for a month.
And Eugene Levy, that's not a great look. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you can use Vaseline on that and rub it off, and it makes it go away quicker.
What did your daughter say after you got the eyebrows dyed?
Well, she said after it faded for a month, it looked pretty good. But for the just for the first 4 weeks, that looked ridiculous, like a clown.
You probably look like Groucho Marx.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike.
That is so funny.
Yeah, I don't. I just can't. I mean, the Marine with the pedicure in Port Charlotte, that has me a little bit confounded.
Well, but my ex-father-in-law is a Vietnam vet, and he goes once a month too to just get a manicure, and then every 2 months to get a pedicure because you don't want ingrown toenails to start. And
well, you can't cut. You've been cutting your own nails for all your life, and all of a sudden you can't do it anymore. I mean, if it's a physical limitation, that's one thing, but that's not what we're hearing.
No, it's a form of relaxation. It doesn't mean you're less of a man.
It does. It absolutely does.
Some of the plastic surgeries are a little metrosexual, so to speak. But
yeah,
the manicure, like, pedicure, I don't see. You get your haircut, it's just like getting your haircut, Dan.
Like the breast implants for men?
Well, yeah, because they've got the man's ear. A lot of guys have big boobs, and it's a problem.
Well, that's an exercise thing.
Yeah.
Well, or like,
no.
Or
sometimes
like,
it's genetic, too. I mean,
yeah.
I knew one guy worked out all the time, and he still had the flabbies, you know?
Guys that used to do steroids, now they're, you know, regressing to the mean in their older age.
And you can get that fixed. Suck it up, take it in, man. Sew it up. Let's go.
No, I think there needs to be lines of demarcation between men and women, certain spaces that really should be men only and certain spaces that should be women only. And I don't like the blurring of those lines. Mm-hmm. And the nail salon is one of them. Mike in Lincoln Park. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah, he's disguising his voice to make it deeper, sound like more like a man, because he's pro Manny Petty. I can see this already. Mike, go ahead. Mike?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, I get a manicure, pedicure all the time. I work on freighters for a living. I mean, you're in your boots 16, 17 hours a day. Nothing feels better. Nothing. And you know what? Women truly appreciate a man who takes care of his feet.
Yeah.
Is that right? A man's feet is the way to a woman's heart or something like this?
All right. No, not at all. But, I mean, you take your shoes and your socks off, and all of a sudden you got, you know, not looking so good.
Foot jam, toe jam.
Oh, well, all right, thanks for calling, Mike. I mean, that's a little bit different. You do that, and then you say, hey, honey, those dogs aren't going to rub themselves.
Ew.
That's, right?
That is so,
No?
Rubbing a man's foot.
That's why you have a wife. You don't need a nail tech.
No. That's when you offer the mani-pedi.
I guess that's why Dan Proft is single. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hunter Biden business partner Eric Schwerin met with VP Joe Biden some 19 times between 09 and 15, and shocker of all shockers, a PBS reporter. PBS reporter.
Wow.
Somebody's off the reservation. Lisa Desjardins asked Jen Psaki about those 19 encounters between the big guy and Hunter Biden's business partner.
On Hunter Biden, the New York Post is reporting, looking at White House visitor logs, there were 19 visits to the White House while the president was vice president by Hunter Biden's business partner, including one with the vice president. Can you help us understand why that business partner had access and what those meetings were about?
I don't have any information on that. I'm happy to check and see if we have any more comment.
Oh, my gosh.
That's the Pat line, all things Hunter related. She doesn't know. She has no idea where to find out any of the answers to these questions. If only there was someone she could ask about this to try to get more information to provide for the press. But there's just no one. Mm-mm. Uh-huh. By the way, I know people are talking about this book by a couple of political reporters about Biden and Obama and Trump, blah, whatever. Boring. The more interesting book that's coming out June 14th, Hunter Biden's ex-wife, Kathleen Buell, memoir, If We Break, a memoir of marriage, addiction, and healing.
Ooh, no, I'm going to read that.
That should be interesting. But, you know, Kathleen Buell, she's Chicago.
Right.
She went to St. Ignatius. Another great St. Ignatius grad, another great Catholic.
It's not her fault her husband's a hoe bag.
If it was her fault that she chose him. Yeah, well, it was. Yeah. Sorry. No, yeah.
He might
have
not have been that same person that got addicted afterwards.
Nope.
Well, we'll find out in the book.
I'm not having it.
Well,
I
it was
not
disgusting.
Having it.
He left her for his brother's wife.
Yeah, that was before the stripper.
No, he left. Bo Biden died, and then he was grieving with her, and then they got together. And then during that time, he had the stripper.
Right.
And then both of those relationships imploded, and now he's...
And now he's married to the...
The woman he met after... He married her after 10 days.
I need an org chart to be able... Or some sort of flow chart to follow this. More on all of these topics, we're pleased to be joined by Ed Morrissey, Senior Editor, Hot Air, hotair.com. Ed, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. You know, it's just a real conundrum they have over in the White House trying to get answers for the press corps on this Hunter Biden fellow who's just a private citizen and his business interests are his business interests. And to the extent that they overlapped where some people he knew may have wound up in the White House 19 times, I just don't know what to tell you on that.
Well, it's clearly not a matter of public interest because Twitter made sure that we didn't know about any of this stuff before the election, right?
And Ann Applebaum at Atlantic wasn't interested in the story. She didn't think it was newsworthy. So that's good enough.
Right. So clearly, our elites have told us that, Hunter Biden and his corruption have nothing to do with this. But by golly, the fact that a billionaire is buying a platform from another billionaire or another set of billionaires, that's the end of the world as we know it.
So Hunter is, there's a lot more chatter about Hunter's legal imbroglio and that he's may or may not still be under investigation by the FBI. He appears to be under investigation by authorities in Delaware, and there's a lot of supposition that he's going to be indicted. This is interesting. I mean, there's some real more aggressive predictions about the end of Joe Biden's presidency coming at the hands of all that shall be revealed about Hunter. I don't know if I'm willing to go quite that far at this point, but it is starting to pick up in pace and attention.
Well, it is, and I think it started with the New York Times, and then the Washington Post finally admitting that the New York Post had it right 17 months earlier, and that maybe they shouldn't have buried this story in the first place. These were... The laptop, the information on the laptop had been verified and corroborated, not just off of the data, but by the other people that Hunter Biden was emailing who came out and said, no, those were our emails. Those are literally our emails. That's exactly what was going on. And you had Facebook and Twitter that suppressed the story. You had these media outlets saying, this isn't really of interest. This has nothing to do with Joe Biden. This is his son, and it has nothing to do with Joe Biden. And then the New York Post, I think it was last week, was reporting that Hunter Biden was using all of this income to basically pay the family expenses. So, yes, it clearly did have something to do with Joe Biden and the Biden family.
And I'm always suspicious about timing. Why do you think that they're finally realizing, meaning they as the mainstream media, is realizing that the Hunter Biden's laptop is really a story?
Well, I think it's because they're expecting the Department of Justice to drop an indictment here. And that was really what the New York Times story was about the fact that that there's a grand jury going on that's hearing evidence now about Joe Biden and on tax and potential corruption issues and potential, Foreign Agent Registration Act violations. And it's the same thing that they got Paul Manafort on. And so I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to get ahead of it a little bit so that they don't look like they have egg on their face when the grand jury drops some indictments here and all of a sudden they've never talked about it. And it that would make them look even worse than how they look now. So I think that was really sort of a hygienic action by the New York Times, and the Washington Post followed up because the New York Times had done it.
Yeah, right. And and that was also a topic that was apparently off limits for Scott Pelley during his interview of Christopher Wray on Sunday night for 60 Minutes, too, unsurprisingly. Switching over to...
It might be more of a Department of Justice issue at this point anyway, so I'm not sure that Christopher Wray would have commented a bit, but one question on it would have been nice, right?
Yeah. I mean, we can't get whether there is a pending investigation or not. We don't know. We know nothing. And these things go on interminably. I mean, this is years now. And if you can't comment on this, then and you want us to have faith in the institution, well, those two things are mutually exclusive. This this cover story for years on end that it's a pending investigation or it's not a pending investigation or we don't comment on what is or isn't a pending investigation. That's a bunch of nonsense. That's just a cover story for skullduggery, as far as I'm concerned, based on the actual behavior of these agencies. And so, I don't know, it just doesn't pass. I mean, of course, he also wasn't asked about the Whitmer kidnapping plot and how that's going in court either, but right. I digress. VDH, Victor Davis Hanson, on yesterday with Martha McCallum, and his reaction to the Musk looming takeover of Twitter, that the offer's been recommended or will be recommended by the board, is very uncharacteristic of VDH. There's almost enthusiasm there, suggesting that it could mean a revolution in the big tech sector. Are you that sanguine about it?
No. I would like to have seen an organic competitor rise up with enough investment to take on Twitter, right? And there's been plenty of people who've tried, and there are competitors out there. There's Gab, there's Getter, there's Truth Social, which is apparently not doing very well. I would prefer that. But then again, it's not my money, right? Musk wanted to buy Twitter to fix Twitter. And so that's completely up to him. I'm not sure that billionaire bidding wars are really what's really going to fix social media here. What I do like, though, is it's really shaking out all the hypocrites right now who are suddenly screaming about billionaire takeovers of communication platforms as if this is something that just happened for the first time yesterday. The most ridiculous of these is Jeff Bezos, who's mulling on Twitter whether or not China has somehow managed to penetrate Twitter through Musk's bid, because, of course, Musk does a lot of business in China. While Jeff Bezos is, A, a competitor against Musk in the space industry, and, B, Bezos does a whole lot of business in China himself through Amazon, and, C, Bezos bought out the Washington Post, 8 years ago, worth $28 billion, he's worth close to $180 billion now, and he has sole control of the Washington Post. The hypocrisy here is just, mind-blowing.
Well, and D, Twitter and these other social media companies have already bent the knee to China. They already have a history of bending the knee to China when it comes to accessing their market. So this would not be novel if they continued to do so.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't get the chance to check it out. There was a link that was floating around about how Amazon bent the knee to China and removed some critical comments from Amazon website over a book about, I think it was about Xi Jinping. And so, I mean, you've got all of this stuff going on. Disney, of course, bends the knee regularly to China. The NBA does the same thing. It's absurd, and the reason why, it's not because a billionaire bought Twitter, it's because the wrong billionaire bought Twitter.
I mean, it's the same thing in politics, right? George Soros is an okay billionaire, but billionaires on the right, the Koch brothers or whoever, they're evil incarnates. Yeah, I mean, and they're corrupting politics with their money and so forth. But the problem is, we were talking about this a little bit earlier in the program, and maybe conservatives need to have a better understanding of who the left is. A friend of mine came up with a good characterization of the left. Pointing out the hypocrisy is fun and it's useful and it has some purpose, but it doesn't get at the heart of the left. That doesn't do anything to the left. And I don't know if it even does anything to those that are open-minded, how many ever few numbers those are in the electorate. The left is like a swarm of killer bees. All they know how to do is attack, and they just go from one spot to the other. The hypocrisy exposing them, it means nothing to them. They pay no mind because they're sort of hardwired to just swarm over here and then swarm over there and then move on to the next thing. And that's maybe what you'll see them do out of Twitter and onto the next thing, or around Twitter for that matter.
Well, and I think you see that in the campaigns to kick people off of Twitter. I mean, these things are organized. They are organizing people to report various different people for getting kicked off as abusive, right? This is what's been going on with libs of TikTok, right? There's been these ongoing campaigns to use the reporting functions to get them kicked off. It doesn't work because libs of TikTok isn't really violating any terms of use. So after all the algorithms get unpacked, they have to bring libs of TikTok back on. What happens? Taylor Lawrence goes out and doxes the person behind it in an attempt to intimidate her off the platform. They've kicked the Babylon Bee, which is a satire site, off of Twitter because of misinformation. I mean, it's explicitly a satire site, and apparently we can have Ali Khamenei on the site. We can have Louis Farrakhan on the site. We can have Nicolas Maduro on the site, mm-hmm. but we really need to be protected from the Babylon Bee on the basis of misinformation.
And what about President Trump? I know Dan doesn't think he'll come back to it. Trump himself said that he's not going to come back, but that's, I think, too enticing. And I think that would have a huge effect on the 2024 presidential race, don't you?
I understand why he's saying that he won't. I think he's got some fiduciary duty to Truth Social, right? And so I don't know that he can come back and start jumping on the competing platform, or at least I think it makes it complicated for him to do so. But I'm with you, Amy. I think the draw is just too immense for him to do that. And so I expect that he'll come back on there if he's running. And I'm not entirely convinced that he is.
Well, it also assumes that Elon Musk will free those who have been gulagged by Twitter, not just Trump, but Alex Berenson and others. We don't know that yet.
We don't. And, I mean, that's the point I keep making, is that I actually don't know what this is going to mean. If it's really going to be that much of a change, I'm hoping it will be. It certainly can't get much worse than what it is right now. Even Jack Dorsey is saying that. I don't know if you saw Jack Dorsey last night, more or less endorsing Elon Musk as the new leader for Twitter. We don't know. We don't know. I mean, it's going to be 3 to 6 months before he even gets his hands on it, because it's going to take that long for the transaction to go through. And I'm sort of reserving judgment, but I am popping a lot of popcorn, and I'm willing to pass it around to anybody else who's really enjoying the view so far.
No, I agree with that. Well, and it was nice, by the way, of Jack Dorsey to take some time away from reading crystals to come out and make a statement. So it is a bizarre, weird, sort of, I don't know, just self-regarding goofball, that Jack Dorsey. But I digress. Ed Morrissey, senior editor, hotair.com. Ed, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.